and welcome to Behind the News for December 4, 2003. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And two guests scheduled for tonight. First, we'll speak with Rita Shera, the, as the Brits say, cephalologist, polling expert, public opinion expert, about what's going on with Bush and the polls. He got a bounce off that fraudulent Thanksgiving trip. We'll ask Rita what's going on with that, and perceptions of the Medicare bill and other kinds of things like that. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Michael Dawson, a sociologist who teaches at Portland State University, about his relatively new book, published over the summer, called The Consumer Trap, all about how marketing works and how they manipulate you. And seemed appropriate interview for this Christmas season. And first, some announcements, and then the news headlines before we get to Rui, who will be coming on in a few minutes. I will be appearing tonight at Blue Stockings, the bookstore, at 172 Allen Street, at just at the corner of Stanton, which is one block south of Houston Street. Closest subway stop is the F train's First Avenue exit, the Second Avenue stop, First Avenue exit. That's at 7 p.m. tonight at Blue Stockings, 172 Allen Street, Lower East Side, just a block below Houston. And I'll be talking about my new book, After the New Economy. And also next week, a week from tonight at 7:30 at the Brecht Forum, 122 West 27th Street in Manhattan, I will be on a panel with Bob Poland, who is the author of a new book called Contours of Dissent, recently published by Versa, which is a look at the 1990s boom as well. So we will be talking about the U.S. economy then and now, and also I think having a little party. So that's a week from tonight at the Brecht Forum, 122 West 27th Street in Manhattan, at 7:30 p.m. And while we're waiting for Rui to call in, a look at the news headlines. I've been away for the last few weeks coming on recording, so I haven't been able to do a look at the state of the U.S. economy, which is generally getting better, although rather slowly and not without contradictions, but generally on the upswing. This morning, however, we learned that a number of people who filed for first-time unemployment benefits, that is people who just lost their jobs and visiting the unemployment office to sign up for benefits, a very timely number and a very accurate measure of the state of the job market. That rose slightly this morning, or it rose slightly last week. It was announced this morning. But it has been in quite a strong downtrend. Just a few weeks ago, it was around a 400,000 level, which is generally considered to be the dividing line between a recessionary and a recovering economy. Now it's down around the 360,000 level. Now it needs to get down a lot further if we want to see an expanding economy. But it does look like the long stagnation in employment does seem to be ending. And tomorrow morning we will get the release of the November employment report, which will tell us all the numbers about the number of new jobs created and or lost, the unemployment rate, and other related information. That is expected to show a modest decline in the unemployment rate, a modest increase in the number of new jobs. Of course, there are always surprises in these things, but that is these are the expectations, and just a continuing picture of a generally improving economy, although very slowly, and not the kind of thing that we usually see in a normal economic recovery, which is typically a dramatic bounce back, but we're not seeing it this time. It's much more of a crawl back, and I think that is a result of a number of things, a hangover from the bubble. And also some structural changes in the economy. Employers much less willing to hire new workers than they have been in the past. Other measures, the ABC Money Magazine weekly poll of the state of consumer sentiment rose last week, extending its rise of 3 or 4 weeks. So it has been, it had been at a pretty depressed level, but now, according to this weekly poll, consumers are showing a happier outlook about their own finances and the state of the economy. These confidence measures are not perfect, but they do reflect, first of all, consumers' perceptions of how the job market looks, but also their willingness to spend money, which is, of course, what this consumer economy is all about. And I said earlier that the job market seems to be improving slowly, and it better happen because the great motor of consumption over the last several years has been housing value. People have been refinancing their mortgages and taking out thousands of dollars, as they do in new home equity. Or rather, borrowed money valued against the borrowed against the value of the improvement in their house price, that's been injecting $300, $400, $500 billion, even $600 billion, according to some estimates, a year into consumer demand, and kept things going even though the job market was weak. As interest rates have been creeping upwards, that phenomenon has been creeping downwards. So we do need to see some employment expansion so that people can buy things with wages and salaries rather than money borrowed against the increased value of their house. And we'll talk with Michael Dawson about this later, but this is, of course, the season of shopping, and most retailers, the dividing line between profit and loss for the year happens right about now. They kind of run in the red all year and hope to make all their money in the Christmas season. As I said, retail spending held up pretty well during the recession, but it has been showing signs of flagging a little bit. And the early signs are that this is going to be a good but not great Christmas shopping season. So we will see what's happening with that. But the early returns are moderately positive, and I think perhaps a little bit below what retailers and analysts were expecting. So we'll see how that turns out. Two surveys came out earlier in the week from the Institute for Supply Management, the people who buy things for corporations. They survey their members in the manufacturing sector and the service sector and ask them what the state of business is. Both are looking pretty good. And for the first time, the employment component of the manufacturing survey has gone positive. That is, it looks like the long slide in manufacturing employment, 39 consecutive months of lost manufacturing jobs, that seems to be on the verge of turning around. We'll see tomorrow whether that happened, but it looks like there could be a small uptick for the first time in over 3 years in the number of manufacturing jobs. And we're also seeing what looks to be a healthy gain in the service sector, employment lagging everything else, as has been the story for this economy for quite some time now. But now the service sector looking to be in the solidly positive column. So, again, we'll see tomorrow morning, but it does look indeed like these things are turning up. And look at a couple of indicators for the foreign economies. European economy is not doing so great. It has been showing some signs of recovery, but now it does seem to be struggling. Sentiment is improving, that is the outlook among businesses in particular, but they're not yet delivering the goods in terms of growth numbers or retail sales numbers or those kinds of things that people look at. Japanese economy, though, however, does seem to be finally ending its long stagnation. It's now had 6 consecutive quarters of positive growth. Not very strong numbers, but still a lot better performance than Japan had been turning in for most of the previous decade. So this may look like the end of that long stagnation, although we'll see how sustainable it is. And over the next couple of weeks, several weeks, I do want to get some guests on to look at some other major economies that we don't really look at. I do want to have somebody to talk about Japan, what's been going on there, and how bad the situation is, and whether it is indeed recovering, and what the effect on real people has been of that long, decade-long stagnation. And also I want to have people on to talk about what's going on with the Indian economy, which looks like it's booming, at least in some sectors, and China, which has been turning in a tremendous economic performance, and I want to look behind that, what that means, whether the numbers are to be believed, and whether that means that people are actually any better off, or it's just a phantasmic boom. So over the next several weeks, we'll get to all those topics. But now we're joined on the line by Rita Shera, who is a fellow at the Century Fund, formerly the 20th Century Fund, and he is the author of a weekly email or web look at public opinion called Public Opinion Watch, which you can find by going to the Century Fund's website at tcf.org. And you can subscribe or view it on the web if you like, but Rui is one of those few people who can look at all this polling data and make some sense of it. So now we have him on the line. Welcome to WBAI, Rui.
Glad to be here.
So, first, it did. There seems to be a little post-Thanksgiving bounce in Bush's ratings, whether it's his hyper-secret trip to Baghdad over Thanksgiving and his holding up of the phony turkey, or whether it's the better economic numbers. How real is this Bush bounce, and what do you think is behind it, if it is real at all?
Well, actually, I was going to ask you, what bounce? I mean, I haven't actually noticed anything.
Oh, I think was it Annenberg that did a poll that said...
Yeah, but the Annenberg poll was way out of line with everybody else to begin with. I mean, in other words, their approval numbers have been running high. I have no idea why. And I guess Annenberg isn't where I turn for my Bush approval numbers, so I'm not sure it means anything. I'd have to see another poll or two before I believe this was real.
So what is the state of the man's popularity now?
Well, I would say, ruling this Annenberg one out, I mean, his approval rating was looking like it was in the low 50s in almost every poll that's come out for the last period of time. There was a little bit of a bounce when the economic news came out, but that quickly dissipated. So you have your last four or five major polls having it at 50, 51, 52%.
As Matt Taibbi refers to him in The Nation this week, that werewolf in the White House. What about the division between approval of his policies and approval of him as a person? Are they moving in the same direction?
Well, again, that's something that I think is needs to be defined more closely. If you just look at the issue of do people like him personally, you get fairly steady ratings on that. If you look at a variety of other personal ratings about Bush, like do you trust him? Do you think he cares about people like you? Do you think he's fair? Do you think he's conducted his administration in a nonpartisan way? Do you, so on and so forth. Almost all of those things have been going down. Even his rating as being a strong leader has been going down. So the thing that people are usually referring to when they say, Bush, people still like Bush personally, it's literally just that. I mean, that they sort of say he's kind of a nice guy. They approve of him as a person. But every other indicator about what Bush as a person is like, any specific, has actually been going down.
Well, let's look at some of those things. First of all, it wasn't all that long ago that it looked like the economy was his weak spot, but he was invincible in Iraq. Now that seems to be turning around a bit. How do those two things stack up?
Well, we know that there has been, the one thing that's happened since the Good Economic Report came in is that his approval rating on the economy has improved some from being abysmal to merely being sort of bad. Most polls still show him with a net negative approval rating on the economy. In other words, higher disapproval than approval. But the thing that's really happened that I think makes the biggest political difference, and it's really shifted the terrain the most, is that if you look at his rating on Iraq and on foreign policy, but particularly about the situation with Iraq, they're really the bottom has fallen out of those ratings. I mean, they've gone from being in the 70s when the troops moved into Baghdad down into the 50s and below now, and basically are net negative in most polls. So people really don't approve of the job he's doing in Iraq. They really don't think he has a clear plan for getting us out of there. They really don't trust what he says about what's going on there, and they think the level of casualties is unacceptable. In a lot of polls, you're moving toward an even split about whether it was even worth going in there or not, which is actually quite a change. So I think, the rap on the Bush presidency has always been where people may not approve of what he's doing in the country in general, but because they approve of what he's doing internationally, because they see him as a leader protecting us in a world fraught with terror, that would bail him out. And that's why people thought he was invincible a year ago when the GOP did so well in the 2002 elections. It was really predicated on this idea that there was this overwhelming foreign policy advantage for the Bush team. Now, clearly that's dissipated, or clearly it's been called into question. And I think that's the really significant change.
Well, it seemed for a while that, as the theorists say, the master narrative of the Bush administration was the war on terror. Did that stick for a while, and is that slipping now as a master narrative?
Yeah, well, that's slipping too. I mean, one interesting thing is that if you the one poll rating that's still holding up better than any other in the international area is Bush's rating on handling the war on terror. But even that's now declining. It's now below 60% in most polls that I've seen recently, which hasn't been seen since, you know, after September 11, 2001. So even that's weakening, and you get a lot of, you know, recent poll came out that said that most people don't see Iraq as being central to the war on terror, so they're not really on board with that. Another poll, interestingly, asked, well, how do you think he's handling the war on terror here at home, and how do you think he's handling it abroad? And actually, his rating on handling the war on terror abroad was pretty poor. It was pretty close to his rating on handling the situation in Iraq, which makes sense, since they've kind of collapsed the two.
Well, the domestic front in the war on terror consists, it seems to me, of mainly harassing people of Arab origin and while leaving chemical plants and ports and nuclear facilities largely unprotected. So what is this domestic front in the war?
Right. Well, I share your view that the war on terror in the United States hasn't been prosecuted particularly effectively. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to have penetrated the typical voter at this point, because if you look at his approval ratings in this exercise on handling the war on terror at home, it's actually pretty high. And I've seen that in other polls where you have sort of related questions. People still seem to think he's doing a good job keeping us safe at home. So I think that's an area where Democrats and progressives are really going to have to hammer away at him, that in fact the whole war on terror is, or its most meaningful parts at home, have really been drastically underfunded. Other priorities have taken their place. The money's been used for other things, and we're really not that safe. I think that's a case that needs to be made. But, you know, looking at the data right now, it's still an area of strength for him, oddly enough.
Well, but at least we have to take off our shoes before we can get on an airplane now.
Yeah, right. There's that.
Regardless of the personnel involved, it does seem that the Republicans have long had this kind of natural advantage as the protector party. It's kind of like the big daddy patriarch that keeps us safe, and the Democrats have often looked rather pathetic at trying to compete with that. Are there any signs that's going to shake, or is that still a pretty firm party identification?
Well, I think it is built into the images of the party, you know, that the Republicans are going to do best when they can take that part of their image and really, really kind of burnish it to a high sheen. And I think they were able to do that after 2001. I think the problem for them now is that while they start out with a presumption in their favor of the part of the public, a lot of that's been undercut by what's happened in Iraq and by people's sense we're wasting our money, people are dying, it's not really making us any safer, and so on. So while they start out with that presumption, they manage to, in fact, take away a lot of that advantage. And the Democrats have potentially an opportunity to present themselves as, well, maybe they're not the first person you'd call to help make the U.S. safe. Maybe that's not fair, but that's, I think, the presumption of the public. But maybe they now have an opportunity to put themselves forward as being able to do a better job, you know, that, in fact, the priorities of the administration aren't the right ones if we're going to actually try to make the country safer.
I'm speaking with Reed Teixeira, who is a fellow at the Century Fund and an expert on public opinion, author of the weekly email and web bulletin called Public Opinion Watch, which you can find out all about by visiting the tcf.org website.
And don't forget my blog, Donkey Rising, too.
Oh, please do provide a plug for that, then. How can people find that?
Well, that's at emergingdemocraticmajorityweblog.com. Like, you can easily, you know, just chunk Donkey Rising into Google, and it'll come up right away.
All right. Well, so speaking of that rising donkey, what, you know, we're in this strange phase now where we have these Democratic candidates all competing with each other and not really grabbing too many imaginations around the country. But if the Republicans have this deep-seated advantage on the national security kinds of issues, what, if anything, do the Democrats have some kind of advantage on?
Well, they still have the advantage on virtually every domestic issue you can name, with the possible exception of taxes, but that depends on how you phrase the question. And they still get the advantage on the economy. So clearly they've got to press that, and as I kind of alluded to earlier, I think they have a great opportunity to, and if not completely eliminate, really dramatically close the gap with the Republicans on national security. And that's what the Republicans have always hoped they could use to bail themselves out in 2004 and forthcoming elections. That was the whole idea of there was supposed to be in the Republican sort of most triumphalist dreams, they say, you know, the rap has been that after September 11, 2001, a realignment has taken place. It's so changed the world dramatically that now everything revolves around the axis of national security, the war on terror, and since the Republicans are the right party to do that, the Democrats are toast. So I think that's really been undercut quite dramatically in the last year, and I think the Democrats really need to run on both things. They have to run on national security, and they have to run, of course, on, you know, they can do a better job with the economy, the domestic scene in general, and they have a better plan for the future of the country and where we want to go than the Republicans. I think they can do both, and they have to do both.
Is the economic issue totally hostage to the business cycle? So if we see a recovery over the next several months, that, you know, all the long-term structural issues of job insecurity and poverty and inequality, do those really take a backseat to whether the GDP line is rising or falling or personal income?
Well, I'm not persuaded of that. I think that you can have the economy growing at a reasonable rate, you know, 3.5% or whatever it might be in the middle of next year. And if the job situation hasn't really picked up and there's still a lot of unemployment and there's still a lot of job insecurity and there's a lot of sense of flux in the economy that produces a lot of uncertainty in the way people view it, I think the Democrats are still going to be able to make their economic case. But I don't think they're going to be able to rely just on pointing to a bad economy or an economy that has some problems as lifting them. They've got to be able to provide people with a vision, as it were, of where they want to take the country in the future, how they want to make the economy work better, what are their plans for education, what are their plans for the environment, what are their plans for, you know, the kind of economy we want to have in the future. So I think they've got to be broader than just talking about, you know, Bush did a lousy job with the economy. Even if it's growing, it's still screwed up in a lot of different ways. It can't just be a negative case, in other words. I think that the economy is going to be growing fast enough probably in the middle of next year that, you know, you won't be able to just make the negative case. To some extent, though, this was even – if you look at the Clinton campaign of 92, I mean, the level of economic pessimism was much higher in 1992 than it's likely to be in 2004, and Clinton was able to run fairly effortlessly against the Bush economy. But even there, he felt he needed to put some sort of positive program in play. So, I mean, I think even more so than in 1992, a 2004 Democrat is going to have to not only run against a bad economy, but also provide a clear way of doing something about it and sort of making the future more positive.
A lot of Democrats are now worrying about the deficit and fiscal ruin. Does that kind of issue have any salience, or is it only policy wonks that care about that?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think that for people it's a symbol of priorities that are out of whack. So I think you do have to talk about it. I think that, and I think you can definitely score some points about the Bush administration and their stewardship of the economy and the budget. However, I think the polling data has never been very strong that this is, you know, the economic issue that people care about and that people buy the sort of crowding out hypothesis about investment and stuff. Like, people don't understand any of that stuff. I mean, people at the Brookings Institution and Robert Rubin may believe all that stuff, but the typical voter does not. I mean, deficits for them, again, is more a symbol of profligate government and misguided priorities than it is an economic program in itself. So if the Democrats are seen, or whoever runs is seen as, you know, that's their economic program, I'm going to balance the budget, get our house in order, and then we'll see down the road about, you know, what we can do about the rest of America's problems. I think that's probably a loser. I don't think you want to do that. I think you want to criticize the fiscal stewardship of the Republicans, but you want to have an economic program that goes far beyond just being fiscally responsible.
And closely related to what you're just talking about, the sense that things are out of whack, is the classic pollster's question, are things in the right track or the wrong track in this country? And I think wrong track has been gaining the upper hand lately. Is that right?
Yeah, no, wrong track has had the upper hand for quite a while. And one interesting thing, again, about the economic numbers that came out recently is they really weren't able to jog that back toward right direction very much. The polls that were taken after the news came out show, you know, you still have a net wrong track rating for the direction of the country, which is typically viewed as being pretty bad for the incumbent. I think the Ipsos poll, what it had at 40% right direction, 50% wrong track, something like that, one of the most recent ratings. So, that's not very good. actually, excuse me, 38% right direction, 56% wrong track. So it was even worse than I thought. So that's the kind of rating that incumbent administrations are very vulnerable on. So that's not have been flipped around by the latest economic changes. I mean, if it does get to that point, if we see 56% right direction, 38% wrong track, then we'll know that Bush is in pretty good shape.
What do you think is behind that perception, the wrong track?
Well, I think, you know, it's a lot of things are built into that measure. I think that builds in, for example, a lot of the things about the economy that can't be captured just by a strong growth rate. People sense that, you know, there's, you know, a lot of insecurity in the economy, that there's still a lot of unemployment, there's still problems with health care costs, a sense that, you know, literally we're just not going in the right direction. Probably it builds into probably some of that is the feelings about Iraq and the budget priorities, $87 billion for Iraq, and we can't fund anything here, the state and local fiscal crises. I mean, it's all that kind of stuff. That's why it's an interesting measure. It isn't just driven by, you know, what the growth rate was in the last quarter. It's actually more a sense of how people are experiencing the country on the ground.
And finally, I never thought I'd be so enthusiastic about the answer to this question, but do you think Bush is beatable?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's going to be a tough race, but I think he's now vulnerable enough, and his chief area of strength has been undercut so severely that I think a good, tough Democratic campaign could definitely take him out. I don't think they can afford to make too many mistakes, and I think even if they run a strong campaign, it's going to be a very close race. But, yeah, I think they could pull it out.
And any of the candidates in the field up to the task?
Well, I think potentially several of them are. Howard Dean, I mean, it's sort of the two ways to look at it might be Wesley Clark on paper is probably your best kind of candidate because he does the best, would do the best job of remedying the Democrats' weaknesses and sort of reassuring swing voters that the Democrats don't stand for anything dangerous. They really do believe in the national security of the United States. You know, they're not too liberal, et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, Howard Dean, well, he might have some of those problems, would perhaps do a better job, you know, raising money through small donors, exciting the Democratic base, creating sort of having an outsider image of someone who's going to practice a different kind of politics, someone who's really willing to speak his mind. So I don't know. Maybe you could average those two, and that would be your best candidate, but that person's probably not out there.
All right. Thanks for joining us, Reed Teixeira. Reed Teixeira is a fellow at the Century Fund in Washington, D.C., author of the Donkey Rising blog, and author of the weekly email newsletter called Public Opinion Watch, which you can find out about by visiting tcf.org. And we'll be back in just a minute after this musical interlude. That was an excerpt from Pressure Suit by the Detroit techno duo Adult. And do you like my handbag? It's filled with lots of money. I want to spend my money on entertainment, which seemed like a nice intro to our next guest, Michael Dawson, who teaches sociology at Portland State University in Oregon and author of a relatively new book published over the summer by the University of Illinois Press called The Consumer Trap, Big Business Marketing in American Life. And it seemed an appropriate topic for this season of, Russell Baker used to call Christmas the Festival of Consumption. Welcome to WBAI, Michael Dawson.
Thanks.
So, tell us, how do you, being a scholar of marketing and consumption, how do you feel in this Christmas season bombarded with all these messages to buy, buy, buy?
Well, it's always a mixed feeling. I have an 8-year-old son, so I participate a little, but of course, Christmas is a great vehicle for marketing, and it's there are all these statistics that you hear every once in a while about how a huge percentage of retail sales is associated with Christmas. So I'm torn in half about it a little.
All right, well, let's tell us about the consumer trap. Lots of people have written about advertising over the years. Cultural critics love to talk about ads. What is, as they used to say back in the 20s, what is your unique selling proposition here?
Well, my selling proposition is that, the whole thing started with a frustration with the radical literature on consumption. And the problem that I had was radicals like to talk about consumer culture. And that's fine so far as it goes, but from my point of view, consumer culture is sort of a tautology. It doesn't tell you much about the details of what's happening. It tends to shift the focus away from the ruling class and onto the masses, and it doesn't really explain why marketing seems to get bigger and badder and more invasive every year. So what I tried to do was actually take a look at what big businesses are doing to us in detail, sort of in the way that Harry Braverman, for those who know who that was, looked at the labor process back in the 70s, and basically took seriously the idea that marketing is I call following an old phrase, is class struggle from above, basically. And so I looked into the literature and found a way to talk about that and to explain it in much more detail than you usually get from books about consumer culture.
I want to get back to the Braverman angle in a second, but you, even at the beginning of the book, object to the ubiquity of the word consumer, which people use without much thought and without much reflection on what it means to identify just about everybody. What's your problem with the word?
Well, I think it's to put it bluntly, I think it's a word, it's a term of capitalist propaganda. I think if you think about what we do as so-called consumers, the term is meant to denote basically everything that we do in relationship to products, and that includes things like shopping for products, buying products, using products, taking care of products, repairing products, and then eventually, of course, most things that we use, at least a lot of things that we use that we acquire through the corporate economy, wear out and break and become not useful anymore. We have to replace them. Well, that last part is consumption. And that's where the word consumer comes from. And it makes sense from a business perspective to look at people as units who use up your products repeatedly. But I don't think it makes sense at all from a democratic perspective to accede to this terminology. And in fact, if you look at the history of the word, it really was not a word applied to individuals until we had corporate capitalism.
Yeah, it was for a little while years ago, the Census Bureau was actually using the phrase consumer unit in place of household, a good old English word, household.
Yeah,
but we all became consumer units. Fortunately, that didn't stick, I don't think, but it was a strange moment.
Yeah, the word has really taken over.
Now, in the standard economics texts, we live in a world of free competition. Where no firm is big enough to influence prices or the other economic conditions.
Right.
And consumers are sovereign. Consumer sovereignty is one of those sacred concepts of mainstream economics.
Right.
Tell us how this picture is at odds with your view of things.
Well, for one thing, I think still to this day, mainstream economists like to pretend that the world is something that looks a lot like what Adam Smith was talking about, which was really actually kind of a utopian description of capitalism even back in Adam Smith's day. It's never quite worked that way. But, you know, once you had big businesses consolidate and start to merge with each other at the end of the 19th century, if you look at what happened to market conditions, they changed a lot, and several things, several advantages were conveyed to investors through that transition in history, one of which was reduced price competition. Another one was, you know, basically the birth of management. If you think about management historically, there was really no discipline of management until you had big corporations. And I think through those advantages, big businesses have changed the way that capitalism works in a very radical way. It's still all about making money for investors, but the means of doing that are much more powerful for investors than they used to be, and certainly more powerful than they are in mainstream economics textbooks.
And you mentioned Braverman earlier, and one of the central figures of Braverman's book is a fellow named Frederick W. Taylor, and he shows up in your book. Tell us about Fred Taylor.
Fred Taylor, I always say, is if you don't know who Fred Taylor is, you should find out, because he's extremely important. And, you know, it's not that he invented modern management or anything, but he was a publicist for it. And what he did was he basically turned the emerging field of management into a social science, and he systematized it. And he was famous for popularizing the system where you would go around in factories and time what workers were doing and take notes. And these guys were known as efficiency experts. Then you collect the data and you'd analyze it and you'd reorganize the workplace so that you could produce the same amount of products with fewer workers. And Taylor was very famous for this at the beginning of the 20th century. And it had basically, you know, almost incalculable consequences and effects on the production side of the capitalist economy. It's really the secret to why productivity has risen so fast, and why there are so few, one of the main reasons why there's so few industrial jobs left is that Taylor was sort of also the father of automation. And basically, within the field of business, if you ask experts, they all say this is the most important figure in management history. And it turns out, if you dig back and dig around in the history of advertising, not only is there an analogy between what Taylor did within the factory and what we now know as marketing, but also there was even a little direct connection between scientific management or what was called Taylorism and what we now know as marketing.
And I'm speaking with Michael Dawson, a sociologist at Portland State University, author of the book The Consumer Trap, Big Business Marketing in American Life, published over the summer by University of Illinois Press. And it became fashionable for a little while in the late 90s to say that Taylorism was a thing of the past,
right.
He's still very much with us, isn't he?
Yeah.
So let's talk about the invention of marketing. First of all, distinguish between marketing and advertising. I mean, people have written a lot about advertising. Advertising is very visible
sure.
to anyone, but the picture is much larger than that.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, just to finish the thought about Taylor, you know, one of the things that Peter F. Drucker, who's the leading management guru in the world, has said is that the influence of Taylor is actually so deep and wide that a lot of scholars forget it's there. It's absolutely still there. And, in fact, I think it's there inside and outside the factory. But the question about advertising and marketing is, if you look at sort of social, public-minded criticism of, you know, what's called consumer culture, you get a lot of discussion of advertising, and that's great as far as it goes. But, of course, advertising is only a subcomponent within the larger marketing process. And advertising is sort of the end result, one of the end results of marketing operations, which are actually a lot bigger and more complicated than just the advertising that you end up seeing.
What is marketing, then?
Marketing is the application of scientific management, business management, to the conditions that determine how product users relate to corporate products. And so marketing is basically a form of management that's applied to people out there during their so-called free time.
I think you quote some pundit as saying the whole point of it is to the production of consumers, the production of customers.
Yeah, if you look, you don't want to look at economics textbooks, mainstream economics, because economists have basically, you know, pretended like marketing doesn't exist. But if you look at the marketing literature and the business literature, it's very stark and very clear that what we're doing is we're making markets, and we're making markets by managing people.
Yeah, it's actually, economics is even worse than that, because they assume away the whole enterprise of marketing. They think that people come to the marketplace with their preferences formed somewhere outside the market.
Yeah, they treat people as if we're basically pristine, self-contained units of rational calculation. I'm pretty convinced by the people who say, you know, mainstream economics is largely a religion at this point.
Yeah, or as Jim O'Connor once said, it's a form of organized crime.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk about the history of marketing. Advertising is quite old, but marketing isn't anywhere near as old. So
right.
How did this discipline emerge? And it really is a very American discipline in its origins, isn't it?
It is, definitely. I mean, the United States, one of the things that's true of the United States is in terms of salesmanship and marketing, the United States has really been the pioneer and the world leader for 100 years. Advertising, you know, there were advertisements in ancient Rome, and it's an old thing. It's publicizing products, and it's been around. But what happened was, once you got big businesses forming, there are new advantages, including the ability to avoid price wars and the ability to increasingly afford to spend more money on management, allowed them to make higher and higher what I sort of think of as basic profits. In other words, what they pay their production line workers tends to go down, and yet they're able to produce the same amount or more, a greater amount of products. And what they do is they eventually, when that reaches a certain point in the whole economy, you run into a situation where it's tough for these big business managers to find new places to sell things. And what they did, it really took off, the marketing revolution, as it's called within business, really took off in the early 1950s. It was sputtering and coming into formation, I would say, as early as the 20s. But what happened was, after the Second World War, you had a lot of factors come together. There was a fear that there'd be a return to the Great Depression. You had television being commercialized and growing rapidly. And TV, my argument is, has in the United States, where there's really not much of a public TV system, is essentially a subcomponent of corporate marketing. And you had researchers coming back out of the War Department making themselves available for marketing research. And basically, in the early 50s, a lot of the big businesses began to take seriously the idea that you could apply modern corporate management to key strategic areas where you might influence people to buy your product. So you got what's known now in standard management history as the marketing revolution.
A lot of pundits, journalists, write about how the old days, they're thinking, I think, the 50s and 60s, we had a mass market, and now we have much more targeted niche markets than that. But it's from reading your book, one learns that the whole idea of segmenting the market and choosing your targets does go back many decades.
It does, yeah. I mean, one of the, you know, the comparison with Taylor is helpful there, because what Taylor would do is go into factories and watch what workers would do very carefully and take notes and pictures and really observe the details. And marketing starts with the same process. What they want to do is influence you to change your attitude or to change the way things pop into your mind or simply to change the priorities that are in your head or your reactions. But what they need to do in order to do that is to get some detailed information on you. And so right off the bat, after the marketing revolution took off, you, not very long after that, got the rise of what's now known as market segmentation. And what that came from was this acknowledgement that if you were going to influence people, it would be very much more efficient if you first of all figured out who out there might be most manipulable for us. So this took off really back in the mid-50s. And it's of course, now with two-way cable TV and the Internet and supermarket scanners and all kinds of things, there are, you know, just humongous databases out there. It's basically now called hyper-segmentation. There, business gurus have been talking about having, you know, segments of one where they have enough information on you to know you a little bit about you as an individual. So it's really it took off right after the whole marketing phenomenon, and it's basically grown extremely explosively ever since.
And once they've identified target markets and target consumers or even the target of one, how do you reach these people? What's the idea? What kinds of tools do they use to turn that target into a buyer?
Well, it basically is a direct mirror of what they do within factories, which is they study the relevant human processes that lead to profit making. And what they do outside the factory with marketing is they do the same thing. They take a look at which group of people should we focus our marketing on. That's called targeting research. And then what they do is they go out and they try to find ways to get samples of people within their target or their segment to do focus groups on, or surveys, or, you know, Nielsen families, those kinds of things. They try to figure out in more detail how people tick within that segment. And then what they do is they gather up that knowledge and take a look at where are the weak points in this existing set of behavior. Where could we put a little suggestion or a little psychological ploy into these people's worlds that might slightly change how they think or act? And that slight change can sometimes, of course, lead to big changes in corporate sales. So what they do is that once they've gathered the marketing research, they turn around and they use basically everything that they put in front of you, including the product, as what they call marketing stimuli. So marketing stimuli would include the product itself, the way products are painted and designed and packaged and even built from the ground up. They would also then do sales communication, which would include advertising, event sponsorship, promotions. And they would also do, of course, they spend some time lobbying the government to make sure that the conditions are favorable for things like selling automobiles.
I remember listening to Ernest Mandel talking about how a planned socialist economy might use some of these techniques to find out what people really want and plan the creation and distribution of them. So are these things all, by their very nature, sinister, or is it the way the applications to which they're put that you find objectionable?
I think the latter. I think that, you know, I think if you look at the attitude with which big businesses use these research tools, it's very sinister. They do look at people as consumers, meaning just machines through which they can run their products and get money. But I believe that the irony is that a lot of these techniques, if you look at them, could be separated from the profit motive and all of a sudden would be, you know, fairly promising for, you know, what you could call economic democracy or democratic socialism. And what you could do is you could take the methods, get rid of the greedy motive behind the whole thing, and use them as tools for finding out what do people really want within, not necessarily within what we call a market economy. And, of course, that was one of the that's been one of the classic criticisms of socialism is that, well, you know, socialists could take over, but once they did, they'd never know, you know, how to produce good products for people. So I think, you know, I think that the methods themselves are not inherently evil. I think it's the social structure that employs them, which makes it pretty evil.
And I suspect there may be some people out there, you know, kind of rolling their eyes and saying, oh, these, you know, grim leftist man, you know.
Yeah.
People
yeah.
like shopping. It's fun. It's a mode of self-expression.
Right.
It's recreational. It's so. What do you say to that argument?
Well, you know, I guess I say that there's nothing inherently wrong with shopping in itself. I think it the problem has to do with what are people's choices. I think if you look at opinion polls, for one thing, people are enormously frustrated and angry with marketing. To the extent they understand it, but I think, you know, the more people understand marketing, the more frustrated they'll be with it. And I also think that people are really craving, you know, bigger choices about how they spend their time and what their alternatives are in terms of activities. And people are just dying for, you know, more quality time with each other and time to do politics and community things. And, you know, I one of the things that I hope that people will get from looking at my book is I argue basically that people, ordinary people, are really, you know, not really to blame for as much of what's going on as, say, other leftish consumer culture theorists do.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think if you read the consumer culture stuff, the existing stuff, it tends to make, it, at least for me, it tends to make me pretty pessimistic. You basically have the idea that the ruling class wants to spread this ideology of consumption, and it's basically worked and people have bought into it. And the only way out of it is to sort of have a great big giant, you know, refusal that people organize. But I think that if you explain to people how they're seen and viewed and explain to people, you know, how all of this stuff works, why it's a waste of money, and the social costs that come from it, that people could, you know, easily, if they could get themselves going politically, they could make this issue part of a larger social movement. And that there really are, you know, reasons for hope. I think that if you could seize these mechanisms and change the way, basically extend democracy into the area of large-scale economic decisions, that there's a lot of reason for hope for the future. And people could still retain some of the benefits of, you know, private enterprise. I don't think anybody wants to see, you know, all restaurants owned by the state. But we could also take on and change, you know, a lot of the worst aspects of the system that we're living under, and the system we're living under is pretty scary.
I couldn't agree with you more on that one. Thanks for joining us, Michael Dawson. I think
thank
we're
you.
Bring this
yeah.
to an end. Michael Dawson is a professor of sociology teacher of sociology at Portland State University in Oregon, and author of the book Consumer Trap, Big Business Marketing in America. Just published over the summer by University of Illinois Press. And remember, I'll be appearing in just about an hour at Blue Stockings Bookstore, which is 172 Allen Street at the corner of Stanton, one block below Houston on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And also a week from tonight at the Brecht Forum, 122 West 27th Street, also in Manhattan, with Robert Pollan, author of the book Contours of Dissent, and Bob Pollan will be my guest in the show just before that event, so we can talk about the 1990s economy of the U.S. and talk also about what's going on now. So that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news, and I'll be back next week, and let's go out with this classic from Bad Religion.
Brother Christian, with your high and mighty heiress, your actions speak so loud I can't hear a word you're saying. Hey sister, bleeding heart, with all of your compassion.